Now, let's talk about self-assertion. The essence of self-assertion is to respect your own values and live by your own judgment. In this way, you experience integrity. What you do in the world is the appropriate expression of what you are. The ability to be angry or to be aggressive or to stick up for your rights plays a relatively small part in the overall meaning of self-assertiveness. Important as these responses may sometimes be, and of course they can be, they are far from being all that self-assertion entails. In a way, everything I've been discussing in this program pertains to self-assertion. The choice to be conscious is the ultimate act of self-assertion. The decision to be true to the judgments of your own mind is an act of self-assertion. The choice to see is an act of self-assertion. Humility and insecurity are associated with downcast eyes, are they not? Throughout the world today, the most punishable crime in any dictatorship is self-assertion. The exercise of independent judgment and independent sight in defiance of authority. It is an act of self-assertion to challenge any dogma, whether it be in religion, science, government, or the teachings of your parents. It is an act of self-assertion to ask why and to refuse to accept a club, a gun, or a frown as an answer. Thinking back to the Milgram experiments, you can appreciate the self-assertion of those few who retained enough moral autonomy to refuse to push the electric shock buttons. Every new invention, every true work of art, every genuinely creative act, any commitment taken by anyone, anywhere, to his or her own evolution, is an act of self-assertion. On the simple level of everyday life, one of the most important ways you support your self-esteem is through the courage and integrity to say no when you want to say no, and yes when you want to say yes. Sometimes this is difficult. All of us can remember times when fear caused us to say yes when we wanted to say no, or vice versa. And we know how this made us feel. I am not talking about the type of compromise and accommodation that you practice when motivated by courtesy, kindness, or love. I'm talking rather about violations to the self that are neither necessary nor desirable, sacrificing your judgment, values, needs, and self-respect, giving up a deeply felt ambition because others aren't sympathetic to it, sleeping with someone to break a siege because, let's say, you're tired of being hassled, remaining silent and unprotesting when your political convictions are being ridiculed to avoid being challenged, letting go of a personal and passionate vision in order to belong, declining a career opportunity in order to placate a disapproving family, running from the possibility of love because you are afraid of hurt and rejection, fearing to reach out to life because success is not guaranteed. Every act of self-assertion is an implicit affirmation of your right to exist. It implies that you are not the property of others and that you are not bound to live your life in accordance with their expectations. Neither your parents, nor your teachers, nor your friends, nor your colleagues, nor the government, nor the salesperson trying to browbeat you into a purchase you do not want to make. Self-assertion can be frightening. It connects you to your aloneness. Sometimes I will ask a lecture audience, do any of you believe you have a right to exist? Almost everyone responds affirmatively. But when I ask someone to stand in front of the room facing everyone and simply to say, I have a right to exist, and then I will ask the person to take a deep breath and say it again, I have a right to exist, and to do that several times, do you know what happens? Almost everyone, the great majority of people, tend to speak timidly or with hostility or defiantly or apologetically or angrily or defensively or resentfully, anything but simply and naturally. Even after I point this out and remark that no one is, after all, denying the speaker's right to exist, few people can say this sentence with simple, good-natured serenity. Think about that. The average person cannot, with simple serenity, stand up and face a group and say, comfortably, I have a right to exist. Clearly, this anxiety says a good deal about our fear of aloneness and of self-responsibility. It also says a good deal about how we were raised and educated, about the values of our culture. I am convinced there is a place deep inside of us where we know that we do have a right to exist, do have a right to the space we occupy. But we need courage to know it and admit it. That, too, is the challenge of honoring the self. We sometimes try to hide our fear of self-assertion from ourselves. I don't like to be pushy is a sentence we often hear when a person is reluctant to assert a perfectly ordinary right, such as returning unsatisfactory food in a restaurant, or complaining about unsatisfactory service, or challenging someone's rudeness or disrespect. I'm a private person is a favorite way to rationalize hiding our feelings when there is no good reason to hide them, concealing excitement for fear of being thought silly, feeling uncomfortable about holding a lover's hand in a public place, feigning indifference when we're actually hurt or angry or joyful in order to be thought sophisticated. In other words, misrepresenting the reality of our experience out of a preoccupation with our image. Obviously, there are times when it isn't wise to express our thoughts or emotions. I may not tell a client what I think about some behavior if I'm trying to nurture his or her capacity for independent judgment. I may not choose to express my anger at someone's incompetence if I think that doing so will lead to even more incompetence. Instead, I stay focused on the job that needs to be done rather than on my feelings. The fact remains that our lives are filled with situations where it is appropriate and desirable to express what we think and feel. Such expression can be intrinsically satisfying. It can enhance and enliven the moment. It can serve our personal integrity. Instead, too often, we remain silent out of fear. The moment is unlived. For many people, that is the pattern of their entire lives. So they live in a chronic state of tension and conflict that they don't understand. The frustration of their unused capacities for love or creativity or happiness may generate a cloud of rage that permeates their personalities. The following sentence stems are particularly useful to explore this problem. You might want to write them down and work on this issue yourself. Mother was always... Father always seemed to expect. With mother I felt. One of the things I wanted from father and didn't get was. One of the things I wanted from mother and didn't get was. Mother gave me a view of myself as. Father gave me a view of myself as. Father gave me a view of men as. Mother gave me a view of men as. Mother gave me a view of women as. Father gave me a view of women as. Father gave me a view of love as. Mother gave me a view of love as. Father gave me a view of sex as. Mother gave me a view of sex as. Father gave me a view of life as. Mother gave me a view of life as. If mother thought I was in a happy love relationship, if father saw me achieving something important in my life, one of the unspoken messages I got from my mother was, when I think of the ways father continues to affect my life, when people have completed about 10 endings for each of these sentence stems, profound insights typically have emerged into consciousness, insights that often have the power to generate change. Now the person can recognize when the voices within are not their own. Now the person is in a position to begin to question and challenge. But since there are always implied rewards for cooperating with mother's or father's philosophy and life scenario, I try to put the individual in contact with the benefits of this cooperation, the payoff, the rewards. And here are some additional sentence stems for this purpose that I think you might find it productive to experiment with. The good thing about sharing my mother's view of things is, the good thing about sharing my father's view of things is, if I were to go against my father's view of things, if I were to go against my mother's view of things, if I were to live by my own vision of life, if I were to live by my own vision of love, if I were to live by my own vision of women, if I were to live by my own vision of men, if I were to live by my own vision of sex, if I were to live by my own vision of success, if it ever turns out that I belong to myself rather than to mother or father, right now it seems obvious that, at this point, the individual, through initial explorations, can be guided to change behaviors, to step outside of a limiting model of self in the world. The process of individuation and the act of self-assertion here become inseparable. You create yourself through your choices, your actions, and the risks you are willing to take. Breaking free of other people's limiting values, philosophies, and life scenarios obviously includes a good deal more than breaking free of the influence of mother and father. You may need to check and confront many of the basic premises that almost everyone takes for granted. This is a subtle and difficult task because we rarely even know where to begin. The premises that need to be questioned are too much a part of our own thinking. They may pertain to the ultimate meaning of life, the values we live by, the nature of virtue, the meaning of maleness and femaleness, the nature of knowledge or the ultimate nature of existence itself. To think independently and radically about such issues is not easy. The extent to which we do so, however, is the extent to which we attain the fully human estate. There is one more issue we need to address. It is one of the great barriers to individuation, self-esteem, and the art of being. Fear of death, the other side of fear of life. We are mortal. This is one of the givens of our existence. Every one of us, one way or another, must confront the issue of death, our own and that of the people we care about. It would be difficult to name any other fact of life so fiercely resisted and denied. We have many behaviors we use to deny our powerlessness in the face of death, from seeking immortality through children, flags, causes, and fame, to persuading ourselves that we are indestructible by living recklessly, to consoling ourselves with the belief that death is an illusion. So far in this program, we have focused on fear of life, fear of choice, freedom, responsibility, struggle, uncertainty, pain, and failure. Fear of death is the shadow side of the same terror. It is understood even less. The difficulty of accepting and integrating the fact of mortality is as old as humankind itself. But in our culture, denial of death is exceptionally pervasive. In the past, most people died in their homes, surrounded by relatives. Perhaps this helped us accept death as a natural event. Now, more and more people die in hospitals, essentially alone, quarantined off from the living. Death appears all the more mysterious and frightening, remote from our existence. We are less and less prepared to deal with it or to accept it. Just at that moment in history, when the entire globe lies under the shadow of death as never before. In the course of therapy, clients readily disclose their fear of life. There is no need to go searching for evidence of the fear. It announces itself constantly. Fear of death is subtler, less obvious, more indirect in its manifestations. Death anxiety is rarely raised as an explicit problem. We can isolate some especially significant themes. First, it seems obvious that many people experience an underlying terror of death that they hardly ever discuss or even perceive at the conscious level. Second, the problem of death is already a reality for children, and the building of defenses against it begins very early. Third, the denial of death is deeply entrenched and is sustained by a wide variety of maneuvers aimed at symbolic immortality. Fourth, many of these maneuvers obstruct the normal process of development. Some harmful maneuvers include clinging to a child's state of consciousness.
I refuse to grow up.
Avoiding commitment, either to a person or to a job.
If I don't join the game, the clock won't start ticking.
Compulsive sexuality.
See how alive I am?
Keeping frenetically busy.
If I run fast enough, death can't catch me.
Leaving major tasks undone.
I can't possibly be taken away before my work is completed.
Placing relationships with others above personal development.
How can I die when so many people need me?
Taking irresponsible and dangerous risks.
See how invulnerable I am?
Sometimes, when parents die, a child of any age feels rage. Often this is interpreted as anger at being abandoned, or as resentment, since unfinished business with parents must now remain unfinished forever. These explanations are generally true, but there is sometimes another factor. So long as my parents are alive, I can't die, since children don't die before their parents. How dare they betray me by dying? There is another side to this betrayal. Parents may resist their children's growing up because then they are pushed closer to the end of their own life. Death anxiety in parents can thus be transmitted to a child. The child picks up the message that, if I grow up, it will kill my mother and my father. I keep my parents alive by remaining forever a child, and I keep myself alive by the same means, since my parents must die before I do. The ultimate neurotic defense against death is the refusal to live. If I don't come into existence, I can't go out of existence. If I don't emerge as a separate entity, there is no one here for death to touch. If I remain forever undeveloped and unactualized, if I keep life always ahead of me, then death recedes into the infinite distance. Or so I tell myself. To exist has its roots in a Greek word meaning to stand out or to stand forth. All growth, both biological and psychological, entails a process of differentiation from the womb, from my body, from my family, from my most recent stage of development. In differentiation, there is already death, the death of my previous stage of development. So it is differentiation that makes me vulnerable to death. And so, if I refuse to emerge, I am safe. So I can refuse to evolve and wait. I lose myself in my children, my work, my religion, my cause, my homes and automobiles, my guru, while I wait for a rescuer, wait for the universe to take pity on me, wait for some unimaginable solution that will confirm my uniqueness and guarantee my immortality. I tell myself I don't believe in death, that death is merely the process by which a caterpillar is transformed into a butterfly. I learn to call this strategy gaining a spiritual perspective. Meanwhile, the precious days of my life go by, unlived or incompletely lived. I tell myself, what does the moment matter when I am here for eternity? I'll tell my children that I love them tomorrow. I'll correct the problems between myself and my spouse sometime in the future. I'll begin my most important work next month or next year. Why hurry when I have all the time in the world? Then, when I finally do reach the end, I think, wait, wait, it's not fair. I'm not ready. I haven't lived yet. When my life was happening, I wasn't there. Problems that people complain about are often several steps removed from the core difficulty of death anxiety. And if this isn't recognized, a lot of time can be wasted. For example, let's say I'm presented with a client who has failed to grow up emotionally and intellectually. Attacking the problem at the level of self-responsibility will meet with limited success at best if the client's deepest secret belief is that to grow up is to die. Obviously, there are any number of problems that don't relate to death anxiety. But as a psychotherapist, I often find it useful to check out that possibility. When I discover that a connection exists, I find that working at the level of death anxiety is the most rapid way to generate growth. Strange as it may sound, a good deal of effort is sometimes needed for a client to accept the fact that he or she is really going to die. Some of you listening to me right now don't believe you're going to die. The mechanism of denial is very powerful. But the consequence of really accepting the fact of mortality is a change in the client's values and priorities in life, a greater willingness to participate in life. If someone had tried to persuade me when I was younger that I had never adequately confronted and integrated the fact of human mortality, I doubt I would have believed it. I'm sure I would have said all the appropriate and realistic things. Didn't I teach people that one should always live with an acute appreciation of one's own mortality and the mortality of those one loves? But when I began exploring these issues in therapy, then conducting seminars and workshops on the subject of our attitudes toward time and death, I began to realize how subtle and insidious the denial of death can be. My own life began to change in the direction of increased thoughtfulness about my priorities when and as I fully accepted the reality of my own mortality. I began to see how often I had been reckless about time and how I had let myself defer important goals. I revised my will. My wife and I made funeral arrangements so that no one else would ever have that burden. When considering any work or activity, I asked myself, am I confident that this is the way I want to invest my time and life? Not that I don't slip on occasions, or that I don't have the same fits of blindness as most other people, but I do my best to stay connected with my mortality and the mortality of those I love. I find that it's not a morbid thought at all, but an enriching one. It's an awareness that increases my appreciation of the preciousness of life. If we are to live fully in the present, we need the context of our mortality. We need to remember that we don't have unlimited time. The ticking of the clock is not a tragedy. It is essential to the meaning and excitement of life, to the intensity of love, to the intensity of any joy. The glory of life is inseparable from the fact that it is finite. A fear of life and a fear of death co-conspire against growth, individuation, love, creativity, and evolution. An unresolved fear of life or of death equally obstructs the emergence of healthy self-esteem. To accept the reality of death and to love life is one of the meanings of heroism as I understand it. The givens of existence call on the heroic potentialities of our nature. One such given is the fact that we are beings who can use our consciousness to make choices. Another is that our life depends on our thought and our effort. Another is that success is never guaranteed. Another is that some measure of suffering is virtually inevitable for every human being. We have no choice about the existence of these challenges. Our only choice is how we will respond. And one of these challenges, as I have said, is the challenge to love life in the face of inevitable death. To be heroic is to persevere, to love the process and the struggle, to laugh without restraint and to weep without restraint, to remain open and vulnerable, which means to remain feeling, to allow the life force to lift us as high as we can rise, and to be able to say at the end, I loved the adventure of the journey.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Dr. Nathaniel Brandon's presentation of his best-selling book, Honoring the Self. You'll want to listen to these cassettes several times to gain the optimum benefit from the ideas Dr. Brandon has expressed. For another audio journey to self-discovery, you'll want to hear Being the Best by Dennis Waitley. In this program, also based on a nationally acclaimed book, Dennis explodes some of the commonly accepted myths which hold you back from reaching your true potential. He illustrates many of his points with intimate glimpses into his own life. You'll understand, as he did, that by readjusting your thinking and following specific principles, you too can achieve that special success that only comes when you're being the best. In the following excerpt, Dennis Waitley discusses the importance of quality in everything we do.
It's obvious that quality pays in the business world. I believe it also pays in personal life. I've always been a strong believer in quality, doing quality work, giving quality service, and purchasing quality products and services. I believe quality is like a two-sided gold coin. One side of quality includes doing the right things and doing them right the first time. This is how to stay out from under the gun. It's a marvelous time saver and a problem preventer and a relationship builder. The other side of the gold coin of quality involves your willingness to invest your money in what lasts you longer and serves you better. There is usually a definite relationship between quality and costs, but those who buy things only because of the impressive price tag are missing the real point. Far better to buy something because of how much it is worth. Buy the quality car, not because you want to impress your neighbor, but because it will last longer and give you a better and safer ride. Buy the handmade item of clothing, not because of its label, but for its better fit, wearability, and style. Quality is smart is not a yuppie slogan. It's a truth to practice every day. If you had to make a parachute jump, where would you shop to get outfitted? Would you buy your chute at a discount store or the flea market? When shopping for something on which your life would depend, would you look for a bargain? Or would you go to the expert with the best reputation and a price to match? That's what quality is all about. Quality means that you can pull the ripcord, press the button, or turn on the engine, and you know that what you're counting on will work again, again, and again.